Chapter 11, The Dumbbells. We can remember in early days of boyhood, watching with wondering admiration the performance of a leading athlete as he gave a public demonstration of what could be done with properly trained muscles. The grand circle on the horizontal bar, the extraordinary flights from one trapeze to another, the winding up of incredibly heavy weights by apparently easy wrist work, and the graceful progress on the hands along the parallel bars. The demonstrator gave a piece of advice that seemed strange to us at the time, although it was based upon a very simple truth. He urged us to use very light dumbbells for our exercises. It was far better to begin with pound weights than with the heavy loads to which our ambition inclined. To drive home the lesson, he gave a demonstration of how a certain pupil who had spurned this advice came along the parallel bars. We laughed, and our interested amusement drove the lesson home to the most permanent shelf of memory. Many years later, we chanced to meet a young fellow who had been trained by a well-known strongman. Before we knew of his training, we were amazed at the development of his muscles. When he explained the kind of exercise he had regularly practiced, it was easy to recognize another illustration of the principle of the dumbbells. This young man informed us that we might easily effect a great increase in the strength of our muscles by a proper application of the ordinary duties of life. Walking, carrying a bag, might become almost as good exercise for this purpose as the most ingenious and expensive of developers. The set position must be avoided. The bag must frequently be changed from hand to hand. Sometimes the arm should be turned with palm outwards. Sometimes the elbow should be bent and the weight raised. Above all, he urged, that the mental attitude must be right, with a conscious aim at increase of strength. We never made a thorough test of these possibilities, not being much interested in the idea of abnormal physical development. We were more interested in the application of the principle on other planes. We believe that all that the young man claimed was true in connection with the growth of muscle. We know that it is true in connection with the growth of the mind. On the mental, moral, and spiritual planes, it is certainly a fact that we need exercise to promote growth. And it is equally true that some of the best exercise can be found in connection with the ordinary duties of life. We can, in fact, transfer the young athlete's words to a higher plane, and turn his literal language into a figure of speech. While walking along the busy street carrying our bag, or helping other people to carry theirs, we can find some of the best exercise for the development of moral strength. This principle of the dumbbells may be stated in a series of incontrovertible propositions. Number 1. The law of growth on every plane is through nourishment and use. Number 2. These two necessities must be properly balanced, with neither stint nor surfeit, without either idling or overstrain. Number 3. Mental, moral, and spiritual food is plentiful and much cheaper than food for our physical needs. And number 4. In human life, as at present constituted, we can find constant exercise for thought and for moral restraint. Now, these propositions do not need much elaboration, but they offer ample scope for cogitation. Even the first, although it states such an obvious truth, may easily be provocative of very helpful thoughts, especially if the reader has not hitherto heard the truth expressed in this way. Everyone knows that it would be the height of folly to expect a child to grow strong without proper nourishment. Everyone knows that it is equally futile to expect strength to come as the result of food alone, without exercise, and the proper use of the growing limbs. Everyone, in fact, is fully aware that a reasonable balance of nourishment and use is necessary for the development of physical strength. But everyone has not thought of the simple fact that the same principle applies with mental and moral growth. A different kind of nourishment is needed, and a different use is made of it, but the principle remains the same. The brain, of course, has a physical basis and needs material food. But there is not much in the idea that certain substances are of especial value as brain foods, as distinct from the physical needs. If the body is well nourished, it will give the brain all it requires as a physical basis. A very different kind of nourishment is needed, however, before any work can be done. The mind must receive impressions through the senses, either by direct observation of nature or through the teaching of other intelligent beings. Then the brain must make use of this mental food, remembering, imagining, thinking, and willing. Sometimes it may be producing ideas which are valuable in themselves, sometimes only having exercise of no more practical value than the dumbbell drills of the muscles, but in either case, making use of the nourishment supplied, and so growing in strength. It has been stated that the majority of people in the civilized world do not develop their minds at all after the age of 15 or 16 years, with the result that only a small proportion of their potential mentality is used. We may hope that this statement is somewhat exaggerated, but it is easy to see reasons for it to be true. Boys have to use their brains while they are at school, and when they first learn to perform the work by which they shall earn their daily bread. Many of them, however, perhaps the majority, find work which gives little or no scope for mental exercise. The youth becomes a tiny cog in the great machine of our complex industry, with uninteresting routine work to perform. At the end of the day, he is tired with the monotony of his labor, and he seeks diversion at a picture house or variety theater. He glances at the daily paper to find news regarding sport, or perhaps to find confirmation of his political opinions. The highest praise that could be given to his amusements or his reading would be to say that they are not definitely harmful. There is no proper nourishment for the mind in these things, and there is no proper use either. If, therefore, the youth fails to develop a line of interest that will supply the needed mental food, there is a danger that the mind will cease to grow. It is a menace to any state if a large proportion of the citizens have the passions of men and the mentality of children, while at the same time they are free, articulate, and self-conscious. If, however, a youth desires to develop his mentality, this is a day of amazing opportunity. The young man who works in a factory, monotonously repeating a simple process in some mass production enterprise, may be worse situated than his forefathers in the matter of the interest attaching to his daily labor, but he is far more favored in other ways. If he can only appreciate the fact, he is living in an extraordinarily interesting age, and in many respects a greatly privileged age. He has been taught to read, and there are thousands of good books available. He can hear good music and good lectures, and he can have access to libraries where it is easy to study any subject that may interest him. Such a youth might ask, what is the use of such efforts? It is not easy to answer that question. It may be that he himself is of no use. If he chooses to live on the animal plane, working only under compulsion, and snatching such crumbs of animal pleasure as he can find, there is no human authority to stop him. All that we desire to emphasize for the moment is that the principle of the dumbbells applies in the matter of mental and moral development quite as much as in the growth of muscle. The dumbbell exercises are not profitable in themselves. but there is real value in them if the young man wants to develop strong muscles. In the same way, if he desires to develop his mind, there is real value in mental food and mental exercise, even though there seems to be no immediate object beyond. It might transform the life of youth if at the right moment he could be made to appreciate this simple truth regarding nourishment and use as applied to the mind instead of merely to the body. Our second proposition is that these two essentials must be properly balanced. There is no need to comment on this fact as applied to physical development. Everyone knows that an excess of nourishment makes a man fat and flabby. On the other hand, excess of use may lead to collapse. That is what is meant by an athlete being overtrained. He lacks the nervous force to sustain the strain. Rather, less exercise, and perhaps rather more food, would have been better for him. Everyone perceives the need for balance here. Comparatively few people, however, realize that the same truth applies to mental processes. There are men who are gluttonous for mental food, and they perhaps choose food of the best kind, the best books, the best music, the best lectures. They suppose that by omnivorous reading, they are developing their minds without the need for anything more. In actual experience, such a reader gets mental indigestion. He grows mentally fat and flabby. He is apt to lose the capacity for intelligent thought, and he may become the unstable convert of the last book he reads. Robert Hall made a witty comment on such a reader. He was no doubt a clever man, but he had so many books on his head that his brain could not work. On the other hand, it is quite possible for a man to go to the extreme of excessive use with insufficient nourishment. We may sometimes hear a fluent speaker. We may read the work of a ready writer who would be better to remain inactive for a time in order to study and acquire knowledge. In other words, he is not absorbing enough mental food for the amount of mental exercise. A better balance is needed. On our third proposition, as to the plentiful supply and the cheapness of mental, moral, and spiritual food, may be resented as seeming to lower the subject. It is, however, a very practical and necessary consideration. A professor at one of our universities might need to spend 50 or 100 pounds a year on books to keep him abreast of the times. A working man, however studiously inclined, could not be expected to spend more than as many shillings. The professor, however, would be the first to admit that the most expensive and the newest of books are not always the best. In his position, he needs to read much that is unprofitable and that he would never recommend to the working man. For the supply of mental, moral, and spiritual food, the old books are often the best. The old bindings were certainly better than the modern, and often the best books have been so little read that they are quite clean even when they are second-hand. Any working man who likes can have a good selection. We have sometimes been surprised at the poverty-stricken libraries in the homes even of men who were supposed to be interested in such matters. A few relics of school days, a few trashy works of fiction, perhaps a really good book with leaves still uncut. On the other hand, we have sometimes been more agreeably surprised to find an excellent selection of books in a very humble home. We have been told what some of them cost. Some of the best, from the point of view we are considering, have been purchased in excellent condition for a few pence. It is certainly true in these days that mental, moral, and spiritual food is much cheaper than the material food for our physical needs. There is no need for anyone to starve on these plains. Our final proposition is that some of the best exercise can be found in everyday experience as we pursue the ordinary duties of life. Here, we think, the truth is even more obvious in connection with mental and moral development than on the physical plane. If the daily task calls for any thought at all, it offers the dumbbells to the worker and begs him to use them. If it is such prison-like work that it becomes absolutely mechanical, the worker can carry it forward mechanically while thinking of other things, and thus finding still better scope for mental development. In these days, workers have ample opportunity and spare time to lay in a store of mental nourishment for their thoughts to use as opportunity offers. Unfortunately, many workers have no appetite for spare time studies and no interest in the possibilities offered by the daily task. We have heard men say, "I am not paid to think," as if that settles the matter and excused all lack of interest in their work. They might add that they are not paid to keep physically fit or to keep the various organs of the body in proper working order. A man ought to be interested in attaining to a reasonable degree of self-development, quite apart from the consideration of the wages he may receive. The stupid refusal to exercise thought in the daily task because the pay is inadequate may injure the employer a little, but it injures the petulant worker far more. Interested and intelligent labor, with unpaid brain work thrown into the service, may or may not lead to promotion and material success, but it certainly leads to mental and moral development. Churlish employers may fail to realize their obligations, but nature will not make any mistake over the principle of the dumbbells. Imagine two youths obtaining their first situation as unskilled laborers in a warehouse where the products of many lands are stored. Neither is paid to think. They are paid to do as they are told, whether in the moving of goods or sweeping up the warehouse. One works with eye service merely, with no thought except for the money he will get and the shallow amusements in which he will indulge when work is over. The other takes an intelligent interest in everything he handles and continues the questioning spirit that develops the mind of the child. What is the use of these articles? Where are they produced? What subtle distinctions of quality can be noted and remembered? We are not considering the matter from the point of view of material success, as it is called, so we will not attempt to follow the fortunes of the two youths. The one who secures all the knowledge possible as to the nature and value of the goods he handles is certainly more likely to make progress in the business than the other. But that is not for the moment the point we desire to emphasize. Whether fortune smiles on him or not, he receives full value for his interested service in his own mental development. He is using the dumbbells of the workaday, and nature will make no mistake as to the effect. The simple truth is that nearly every task that men are called upon to perform offers scope for thought. Every part of either town or country through which men have to pass on their way to work bristles with problems, inviting observation, comparison, judgment, imagination, constructive reasoning, and often calling for action. These dumbbells of the workaday are, perhaps, neglected because the stores of mental food in our libraries are so large and so concentrated that these little possibilities for mental exercise seem too trivial to be noticed. Herein is one of the tragedies of civilized life. Men neglect their powers of observation because they can have access to so many good books, and yet, after all, they fail to read the books. We would agree that reading gives us the richest store of mental nourishment, and it must not be neglected. We must not read too much, however, nor too quickly. We must read analytically, getting at the root meaning of each sentence and forming comparisons and judgments of our own. the man who can coordinate his reading with his own observations and do some hard thinking on the basis of the things read and observed, is making the proper use of the principle of the dumbbells in the development of his mind. Perhaps someone will suggest that in these considerations, we have not at present touched much on the subject of moral development. It may be admitted that civilized life offers much scope for mental exercise, but where are the dumbbells to assist the moral side of our nature? If any reader is disposed to put such a question, we must remind him that we are trying to survey the principles that should guide the life of a Christian. It might be rather difficult to find dumbbell exercises for a pagan morality in the ordinary experiences of civilized life, but exercises for Christian morality offer themselves every few minutes. Remember the major principles of faith and recognition of God in all things, of obedience to divine law, of love and service to humanity, and to the practical bearing of the Golden Rule. In the ordinary experiences of life, there are so many ways of being immoral that the contrary possibilities are always with us, and the dumbbells of little exercises are constantly to hand. The youth in the warehouse could find so many ways of contravening Christian principles that there is no lack of opportunity for dumbbell practice, even there. One who is honest in matters of money is often flagrantly dishonest in matters of time and service. One who would not on any account take 6 pence from his employer's cash box will rob him of 6 pounds through wasteful and destructive carelessness. There are indeed many degrees and different standards in most of the virtues, but it is not difficult to determine which is the standard set by the Christian religion. We are to do all things heartily, as unto the Lord, and not unto man. We are to accept adverse experience patiently, even if it does not seem in any way deserved, and this patient endurance is to be sustained even to the rendering of service to a bad master. The young Christian who has occasion to follow the Apostle's instruction in this matter will not complain that the dumbbells are too light for him. An ordinary man, whatever his position in life, may find opportunity for moral exercises from the time he rises in the morning until the last thought before relapsing into slumber at night. It may seem absurd to suggest that a little difficulty in dressing, a refractory collar stud, for instance, could offer a possibility for exercise and Christian control. It may be that a man would be right in regarding such a matter as too trivial for consideration. If so, it is equally clear that such little trials should equally be too trivial to disturb his tranquility or to occasion any expression of anger or annoyance. Herein lies the real test. If a man allows such trifling difficulties to arouse his anger, to cause the use of undesirable expressions of annoyance, he must certainly not say that the matter is too small to offer opportunity for dumbbell practice in Christian virtues. It is obvious that this is just the kind of exercise that he needs. Often a man will reveal his weakness in a score of different ways before the real work of the day begins. He is unjust and unkind to some of the members of his family because of some little annoyances for which they are perhaps not to blame. He is unjustly angry with the omnibus conductor, either because the decision as to the limit of overcrowding just excludes him, or because it allows too many on behind. Unmindful of the Golden Rule, he puts his feet on the cushions of the railway carriage, although he greatly resents the same practice in other people. He talks about acquaintances as he would not like others to talk of him. All the time, it might truthfully be affirmed that God is absent from all his thoughts. When we remember that according to the Scriptures, it is sin if we know to do good and do it not, and further, that whatsoever is not of faith is sin, we may be forced to conclude that a man might easily load himself down with little errors before the serious evils of the day began. In all these matters, we have the offer of light and easily handled dumbbells. If we despise them, because they are so light, we commit a double error, and there will be no failure in the law of cause and effect. We have several times referred to spiritual development as something beyond the mental and moral. Many readers will agree that there is a distinction, however difficult it may be to define. Perhaps the best description of the word spirit is that it is the essence of the whole, and this thought may serve to suggest a definition of the word spiritual. The Apostle says that to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. He further says that if a man has not the Spirit of Christ, he is none of his. The question may be asked, can we find spiritual exercises in the experience of ordinary life? Can we, in addition to the mental and moral exercises that are obvious, find something more as suggested by the word spiritual? We may well hesitate to answer the question either yes or no. It might be more correct to say that we can find spiritual food and exercise in spite of the experiences of everyday life. In another fuller sense, however, we shall have to agree at last that the mundane experiences are necessary, even in this. True spirituality is instructed, and must, therefore, be based on mental and moral training. Spiritual exercises stand in relation to this training, as the performance of the symphony is to the practice, and the rehearsals that make such performance possible. During the period of training, with constant, unpleasant corrections and reproofs, there is not much scope for tasteful performance. A little of such privilege can be secured, however, even then, enough to suggest the great possibilities when the period of training is over. Here we touch the essence of all that is involved in the word spirituality. At its best in mortal experience, it only seems to hint at the great possibilities of a higher life. We are only as babes, not yet come to the birth, and perhaps very few of us ready for the terrible yet glorious plunge into dazzling light. Perhaps the first real breath of immortal life will be as painful to all who are permitted to draw it, and the first real sight of the divine as overpowering as when the newborn child feels the first rush of vitalizing air and sees the bewildering light of day. We need the full period that God has decreed for us, with all the nourishment that we can use effectively. There is a sense in which all our work in service to God is merely analogous to dumbbell exercise, for God certainly needs no help from us. To Him, the value of the work lies not in the service, but in the development of the servants. His people need to be developed in every way for the purpose He has in view, mentally and morally and spiritually. The time for this development is now, and the opportunities are presented every day and almost every moment of the day. Finally, we have to recognize that on all planes, the laws are the same. Only the higher the plane, the slower we are to perceive them. We could find no opportunity for developing either mind or morals apart from the instruction that comes either directly or indirectly from God. With that instruction, we can find food and opportunity for exercise everywhere. It is the same with spiritual values. Without divine help, we should know nothing of the subject, perhaps not even be aware that there was such a subject, regarding which anything could be known. Through divine instruction, and through the exercise of mental and moral faculties, we learn at last that spirituality is at the heart of every truth. It changes the appearance of material things by changing us. Instead of seeking for spiritual exercises and finding them nowhere, we shall, without effort of seeking, find them everywhere. An animal probably does not even see the glory of the heavens on a clear night. A materialistic farmer will watch for signs of fair or foul weather. A scientist seeks to weigh and measure the stars and follow their movements. An artist or poet will respond to the beauty and wonder of the display and express his own feeling in his art. The psalmist perceived all this, and in addition, he recognized the presence of God. Guided by such teaching, we can find the same point of view. Then, spiritual exercises are always within our reach, because God, in the power of His Spirit, is not far from any one of us. No change is needed in the constitution of things. The change must be in the human point of view. This is what the Apostle Paul meant when he wrote, "Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." The little simple exercises of everyday experience, which we have here treated under the symbol of the dumbbells, will inevitably play a large part either in conformation to the perishing world or in transformation to the perfect will of the blessed and only potentate, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who only hath immortality.